Carla Bley from her album Heavy Heart. That was called Talking Hearts. 5:31 on a Sunday morning. And you're listening to Heresy. Oh, are you ever? My name is Sharon Griffiths. Good morning, if you're just joining me. I'm here every middle Sunday, not the first, not the last, of every month. Lord willing and the crick don't rise. I have to read. I have this to read. It's not that I have to read it. A column from the Daily Record, the New Jersey paper from February 91. I don't know the exact date. It was passed on to me by someone else who passed it on to her. And it's by a fellow named Dave Barry, who's kind of a clever guy. And sometimes you have to be suspicious when someone of an ethnicity or a gender pokes fun at themselves and their ethnicity or their gender or their age group or whatever. But this is pretty interesting, and it's not male bashing so much as it is just pointing out some stuff. Let me just read it here. It's called, the title of it, In the World of the Male, Macho Is as Macho Does. Our topic today in our continuing series on guys is why guys act. One recent morning I was driving in Miami on Interstate 95, which should have a sign that says, warning, high testosterone, next 15 miles. In the left lane, one behind the other, were two well-dressed middle-aged men, both driving luxury telephone-equipped German automobiles. They looked like responsible business executives, probably named Roger, with good jobs and nice families and male pattern baldness, the kind of guys whose most violent physical activity on an average day is stapling. They were driving normally, except that the guy in front, Roger One, was thoughtlessly going only about 65 miles an hour, which in Miami is the speed limit normally observed when inside car washes. So Roger Two pulled up behind until the two cars were approximately one electron apart and honked his horn. Of course, Roger One was not about to stand for that. You let a guy honk at you and you're basically admitting he has a bigger stapler. So Roger One stomped on his brakes, forcing Roger Two to swerve onto the shoulder, where, showing amazing presence of mind in an emergency, he was able to make obscene gestures with both hands. At this point, both Rogers accelerated to approximately 147 miles per hour and began weaving violently from lane to lane through dense rush hour traffic, each risking numerous lives in an effort to get in front of the other, screaming and getting spit all over their walnut dashboards. I quickly lost sight of them, but I bet neither one backed down. Their co-workers were probably wondering what happened to them. Where the heck is Roger, they probably said later that morning, unaware that, even as they spoke, the dueling Rogers, still only inches apart, were approaching the Canadian border. This is not unusual guy behavior. One time in a Washington, D.C. traffic jam, I saw two guys, also driving nice cars, reach a point where their lanes were supposed to merge. But neither one would yield. So they drove very slowly. We're talking maybe 1 mile per hour. Drove into each other. Other examples of pointlessly destructive or hurtful macho guy behavior include guys at sporting events getting into shoving matches and occasionally sustaining fatal heart attacks over such issues as who was next in line for pretzels. Guys on the street making mouth noises at women. Boxing. Foreign policy. Why do guys do these things? One possible explanation is that they believe women are impressed. In fact, however, most women have the opposite reaction to macho behavior. You rarely hear women say things like, "Norm, when that vending machine failed to give you a Three Musketeers bar and you punched it so hard that you broke your hand and we had to go to the hospital instead of my best friend's daughter's wedding, I became so filled with lust for you that I nearly tore off all my clothes right there in the emergency room." No, women are far more likely to say, "Norm, you have the brains of an odor eater." But the real explanation for macho behavior is not that guys are stupid. The real explanation is that because of complex and subtle hormone-based chemical reactions occurring in their brains, guys frequently act stupid. This is true throughout the animal kingdom, where you have examples such as male elks, who, instead of simply flipping a coin, will bang their heads against each other for hours to see who gets to mate with the female elk, who is on the sidelines filing her nails and wondering how she ever got hooked up with such a moron species, until eventually she gets bored and wanders off to bed. Meanwhile, the guy elks keep banging into each other until one of them finally wins, although at this point his brain, which was not exactly a steel trap to begin with, is so badly damaged that in his confusion he will mate with the first object he encounters, including shrubbery, which is why you see so few baby elks around. Another example of macho animal behavior is guide dogs, who are so dumb they make elks look like Rhodes Scholars. Every male dog firmly believes that if he makes wee-wee in enough places, he will be declared dominant male dog of the entire earth and receive a plaque plus valuable dog prizes, such as a bag of chicken heads. Of course, since there are several billion dogs in the competition, everybody is extremely busy trying to stay ahead of everybody else. One time, I took a hike on a mountain with two male dogs named Rubio and Mushu. Every 3 minutes, Rubio would carefully select a spot and establish his dominance over it. Then Mushu would come sprinting from as far as a mile away, so that despite having the entire mountain to choose from, he could establish his dominance over the same 4 square inches previously dominated by Rubio, who was by now several hundred yards away dominating a new spot, which Mushu would then frantically sprint towards, and so on all day long, with each dog absolutely convinced that he was the baddest hombre on the planet. At least we human males, don't do that. We don't have to. We have tanks. Thank you, Dave Barry. The companion piece to that is from the Philadelphia Inquirer, perish the thought, from, I guess, a couple of weeks before this, when the crisis was hot and heavy in the Gulf. And by the way, it's not over. It has just devolved itself into another global hotspot. We have stopped calling it our particular war. It's now anybody's global hotspot. There are all sorts of dreadful things going on over there. There are all sorts of dreadful things that will eventually come out of what has gone on over there. And just because the media decides to go on to other things it's amazing. It's a sterling example of how quickly they forget. I would imagine that our news coverage here at the station, WBAI in New York, which is where you are, where I am, has a more rounded, perhaps a more 180-degree view of what's going on instead of the tunnel vision that you see in see and hear on most commercial media. And I will have a story later, an editorial called Media Watch from a women's paper called New Directions for Women that talks a little bit about not so much the inability to the lack of access to all of the news all of the time, to cop a phrase from one of our commercial media stations, but more on the inability of broadcasters and journalists to form any sort of comprehensible English sentences. Sometimes I have that problem myself, especially as it is 5:41 in the morning, on a Sunday morning at that. Anyway, this is an interview in the Philadelphia Inquirer by a woman named Marilyn Lois Polak, and she is interviewing Dr. Sherman J. Silber. And the title is Of Moose and Men. Testosterone makes males sexy and violent, says the hormone expert. But with animals, it's not a global threat. Again, we're talking about moose. First off, the fertility guy and I have a few major differences of opinion. He really wants to have a baby. I don't. He's proud of his miraculous microsurgical techniques enabling even postmenopausal women and vasectomized men to successfully reproduce. I'd rather go to the movies. He definitely does not view modern mainstream medicine as all too often a series of male solutions to female problems more for the convenience of doctor than patient. The fertility guy believes in better living through chemistry, in vitro fertilization, frozen embryos, donor eggs from sister to sister as love gifts, all of which seems to me like Frankenstein playing God. He touts the controversial female contraceptive Norplant while dismissing well-documented side effects of headache, weight gain, depression, nervousness, nausea, acne, increased facial hair, benign yet painful ovarian cysts, and irregular periods. Let's get him a prescription. The fertility guy cheerfully promotes pregnant 55-year-old women who would be a young 80 when the baby's 25 years old. And he chides me when I wonder why he'd want 55-year-olds pregnant. Aren't they tired? And wouldn't they rather sit and watch MTV? Yet, the fertility guy, Dr. Sherman J. Silber of St. Louis, is compelling. This small, energetic man of 50 with three sons, a Shakespearean PhD wife, shining brown eyes and a no-smoking statement tie has achieved, through his upbeat specialty of playing stork at $1,600 a pop, a certain authoritative familiarity with the private parts and intricate psyches and tricky hormonal balances of men and women. Though the fertility guy is plugging his current book, How to Get Pregnant with the New Technology, I'm intrigued by an earlier book of his, The Male. By virtue of his diverse practice, Dr. Sherman Silber has an unusual slant on global chaos and the biological bases of human behavior. As we watch the television now, we think about the war and we wonder, how did this happen? Well, this is not an outlandish statement, but a very scientific observation that this kind of physically violent activity is only possible with men at the helm, he declares. The reason isn't psychological. The issue is the hormone testosterone. That's the same hormone that gets the moose and the ram to almost kill each other to see which one gets to mate with the female, you know, he explains. This hormone, we know in humans and in the male hormone for sure starts our puberty with a spurt of growth. It increases our muscle mass so that men who don't work out have much stronger muscle mass than women. Men always have an advantage. And men always have a higher red blood cell count than women, he continues. And these are the two major effects of that hormone physically in terms of preparing men for battle, so to speak. It's an ancient difference between men and women. But it has an effect on the brain, which allows anger and impulses toward violent behavior to be expressed much, much more powerfully than it ever was in women. And some of the proof of that comes from studies not just of sex offenders, everybody knows about this, but just talking simply about serial killers, where there has been no apparent sexual motivation for serial killing, whether it was the Son of Sam or the killings in Atlanta. We all know every 5 years one of these nuts gets loose, and psychiatrists and psychologists have really studied this very carefully in the prisons, and if you put these men on a female hormone like Provera that reduces their male hormone level, these urges they report of an absolute compulsive need to kill, I mean, they can't help it, that's why they're serial killers, they don't know what they're doing, Well, all those images and compulsions just go away, and they settle down, and they lose the urge to kill. It's amazing, really. It works. It really works. Would an excess of testosterone in a man's blood make him sexier or more violent? Well, it means he has the chemical potential for both, actually. Greater sex drive and greater violence. Then that's the origin of the word testy? Yes, he replies. And horny comes from that also. Because when the moose goes into rut and is about to fight all the other moose and is sexy, he grows these horns. And then after that season of rutting is over, his testicles begin to shrink again in the winter. It's a seasonal periodic thing. He stops making testosterone, and his horns fall off. But don't get him wrong. He cautions, psychological studies show it doesn't mean all men are violent. It always struck me, perhaps simplistically, that men make war and women make up the large chunk of peace movements. Oh, for sure, he agrees. All behavior isn't chemically triggered. But testosterone is just an explosive powder keg that adds tremendously to the equation. How ironic. Folks used to say, oh, a female president, what if she has PMS? Typical, he laughs. That is really a terrible societal pressure, isn't it? Prejudice, isn't it? Or a male-dominated prejudice? Hormonally, the evidence is just overwhelming. Women are more stable and more reliable from a hormonal point of view than men. It's a very interesting contradiction. The myth is that women are unstable hormonally, all that talk about PMS causing them to commit murders. Well, the swings in mood a woman would have when her estrogen levels would suddenly drop at the time of her periods are so minor compared to the constant threat that the male faces to trigger anger and irrational, psychically, physically violent behavior, he says. Can we talk about George Bush and Saddam Hussein? Well, I would just say that men in general are the ones that create the war, and the two of them would be no different than most other men, and that they're more likely to seek violent solutions to things that are bothering them and have a violent kind of physical confrontation, and that is chemical and that is testosterone related. I wouldn't know their testosterone levels. I'm being scientific. But what I believe is happening in most men who are taking the violent approach is that, we've studied this, if testosterone goes above, as long as it goes above a certain threshold level, that's when all this violent behavior can occur, he says. If it's below that threshold level, then you have more female types of approaches to frustration. Men would normally have a testosterone level that would vary anywhere from 300 to 900. George Bush, his problem may be many people have accused him in the past of being a wimp. He might have a general level of 300. He may be trying to prove how manly he is, he chuckles. I really don't know. But what I'm saying is, all you have to do is get over that threshold, and then the violent type of solution to frustration comes out. So what's happening now doesn't prove that Saddam Hussein, for example, has a testosterone level that's three times higher than Hosni Mubarak, who's a fairly peace-loving man. Mubarak's done a great job in Egypt, but it's not related to that. They all suffer from being men. They have levels of testosterone that create in them the possibility of violent solutions, he says. I'm glad you want to talk about that because I'm not trying to sell that book. It's out of print. But I love it. It's an important message for society. Yes, I think I need to get it back in print. Don't put this in. Now I have a more aggressive publisher. It sold very well, but the previous publisher was very unaggressive, he says. Maybe the publisher didn't have enough testosterone. Yeah, he laughs. That's probably a good point. My editor is so funny. She said, let's update your book, The Male. She's certainly the best editor I've ever dealt with, and this is my fourth book for the layman. And I've also written three textbooks. When we talked about this, she cracked up and said, well, I know the problem with the Gulf War. We just need to drop a huge estrogen bomb on the world, and then we'll have peace. Of course, she was right. If there was some way we could disseminate estrogen. Look, please put this in the humorous context I'm putting it in, but it is actually scientifically valid. If we could just reduce the testosterone level in these men, we wouldn't be having these wars. They would sit down and talk about their differences. They wouldn't feel the urge to solve it through violent behavior. That's really true. Let's just advocate dropping an estrogen bomb on the Middle East, she said, and on Washington. I never thought of that image, Dr. Sherman Silber grins. It's so wild. But it would work. It would definitely work. We'd have peace. Now.
It's a long, long way from Canada, a long way from snow chains, donkey vendor slicing coconut, no parkas do. Got a carnival song, we're gonna lay down someplace shady with dreamland coming on. Dreamland, 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 dreamland. Walter Raleigh and Chris Columbus come a marching out of the waves and claim the beach and all concessions. Dorothy Lamour sarong, and I lay down thinking national with dreamland coming on. Dreamland, 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 dreamland. Good time Mary and a fortune hunter all dressed up to follow the drums. Mary in a feather hula hoop, Miss Fortune with a rose on her baking gun. All saints, all sinners shining, heed those trumpets all night long. Propped up on a samba beat with dreamland coming on. Dreamland, 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 dreamland.
so carefully. A defector from the petty wars, it shall shove up away. There's comfort in melancholy when there's no need to explain. It's just as natural as the weather in this moody sky today. In our possessive coupling, so much could not be expressed. So now I am returning to myself. These things that you and I suppressed, I see something of myself in everyone. Just at this moment of the world, the snow gathers like bolts of lace, waltzing on a ballroom girl. You know, it never has been easy, whether you do or you do not resign, whether you travel the breadth of extremities or stick to some straighter line. Now here's a man and a woman sitting on a rock. They're either gonna thaw out or freeze. This strains of Benny Goodman coming through the snow and the pine. I'm porous with travel fever, but you know I'm so glad to be on my own. Still somehow the slightest touch of a stranger can set up trembling in my bones. I know no one's gonna show me everything. We all come and go unknown, each so deep and superficial. Between the forceps and the stone, tributes to finality, to eternity. And then I looked at myself here, chicken scratching for my immortality. In the church they light the candles, and the wax rolls down like tears. There is the hope and the hope I've witnessed 30 years. We're only particles of change, I know, I know, orbiting around the sun. But how can I have that point of view when I'm always bound and tied to someone? White flags of winter chimneys, the moon in the mirrors of a modern bank, from the window of a hotel room.